You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
It is Jay's turn to miss an episode. This is three a row. Completely
Evan,
unplanned.
Kara, yeah, who's next, Bob? You next?
I plan on being sick next week. Thank you.
Jay is at the tail end, pun intended, of a three-day stint of massive diarrhea.
That's so terrible.
That's not too much information, is it?
No. Hey, man, we all get
dehydrated.
Diarrhea.
Yeah, he's got a viral infection, got an enterovirus or something. He's just, you know, totally knocked out. He hasn't been sleeping. He's dehydrated. You know, he's completely
cranky.
Wiped out.
Yeah.
Here's what I blame. I blame children.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
That's a good bet.
And old people.
I've gotten sick more times since working in the group home than I ever got sick before, just because I'm around teenagers. And I don't think they wash their hands that much or something.
And
I don't know.
Jay's oldest is in school. That's it. Yeah. When your kids go to school, you are sick all the time. That's basically the way it is.
Oh, who invented kids anyway?
Seriously.
Yeah, right.
My mom, she was a teacher for, you know, decades. She taught middle school. She was always sick. I feel like every time I would talk to her on the phone, now that she's retired, she's never sick. But every time we would talk on the phone, I've got some, you know, viral thing in my lungs, or she was always coughing and making gross, snotty sounds.
She's not sick anymore because she's already had everything. There aren't more mutations.
True.
She's
caught
it all. Her body's created every antibody possible.
So today is the vernal equinox.
Oh, yes.
Happy spring.
Yes.
One of my favorite days of the year because it's the first day of spring.
Happy birthday, Vern.
Yes.
We are. The sun crosses the equator into the northern hemisphere, so suck it up, southern hemisphere.
That's
we got
right.
The sun for the next 6 months.
It is so weird hearing the way that you guys pronounce that word, which is probably
hemisphere?
The correct way. No. The word right before that, or the line that is around the latitude
equinox?
Line around the
equator.
Equinox. Yeah.
You said it like me the second time.
Equator.
You said blah, blah, blah.
Equator.
This is the equator.
Equator.
Oh,
it's
the equator.
Yeah, the emphasis is on the KW.
On the equator.
It's equator. What are you guys talking about? You had the accent on the wrong syllable.
Exactly.
Look, all I know is our hemisphere is taking the sun back. So
Yeah. The upper half of the analemma. Next 6 months are good.
Oh, gosh. Remember the analemma discussion
we had?
Let's not
talk about that
here.
Again.
Speaking of previous discussions, we talked about bears.
Bears.
Recently, if you remember, we had the whole segment about bears. The bears. What to do, what not to do when confronting bears.
Bear spray.
And I think we've mentioned that there are occasional bear sightings in Connecticut.
Definitely.
We do have
which I have never seen.
A population of black bears. Well, I don't know if you heard this, Bob. Jay heard.
You did.
So I get home at the end of last week.
Mm-hmm.
My older daughter's home from college, and my two daughters were home alone, and they had an encounter with a black bear.
Yay!
Black bears came up onto our deck.
That deck.
Did they record it?
Oh yeah, we got video.
That's great.
There's proof.
They're lucky.
That's where we keep the birdseed. So
So
what happened was it came up onto the deck. It was trying to open the little half-sized aluminum garbage can that we keep the bird seed in. And we put a rock on there so that the raccoons and the squirrels don't get it. And it works. Hmm. But the bear essentially knocked it over.
Yep.
And it made such a loud noise that it scared him. So he scared himself.
Oh, good.
And then he ran off the deck. And then he was just, you know, hanging out. He looked a little stunned. You know, I thought maybe he just woke up from hibernation or something, looking for some food. Left really cool tracks in the snow.
Please don't tell Mom, Steve.
I know. My mother is like paranoid about. She's always talking about.
She's
like,
paranoid.
Bears. She's paranoid. And
about black bears. Why?
And coyotes. And like,
oh, come on. There's a coyote sleeping in my backyard all day yesterday. I thought it might be dead, but it left. Thank goodness.
Yeah. So it wasn't.
Or someone took
nope.
it.
The black bears are not like grizzly bears.
By and grabbed it.
You still, you know, as we discussed, you still don't want to, you know, threaten a black bear.
No,
threaten their food or their kids. Right? Those are the situations where you can get into trouble.
Yeah, don't threaten any mother, her food or her kids. Just leave them alone.
What do you do when a black bear knocks over your bird seed?
Yeah,
you just let him eat it.
You sue it.
You sue it.
See that? Hello. Wait, is this thing on? Hello?
Hi-yo.
Okay.
Oh, no, Evan, they did, hey, he didn't touch the suet.
Talk about black bears and birdseed in the same sort of conversation.
We had to get the pepper suet because we could not keep the raccoons out of our suet. In fact, these
damn their neuronal density.
They are so relentless.
Okay.
I actually had to get, so we finally solved the squirrel problem with the bird seed. I figured we got a squirrel
lasers?
Proof, got a squirrel proof bird feeder. And if anything heavier than a bird sits on it, it closes the holes that the bird seed's in. And then I had to put it on a hook, you know, so that you actually need hands to take it, to unhook it from the arm that we have it hanging off our deck. So you know what the raccoons did?
They grew human
hands. Yeah, they grew opposable thumbs. No,
they removed the entire arm from the deck.
Oh, sure.
So they couldn't get the bird feeder off the arm.
Awesome,
so they
man.
And they
those dragged trash pandas it. Are smart.
Those trash pandas are very smart. They dragged it halfway across the yard. Luckily, they didn't break it. It's like my second. They broke the first one. Ugh. My first $100 squirrel-proof bird feeder. They smashed that to bits. So that's when we had to, like, you know, make it so they couldn't, they physically could not remove that bird feeder from
oh
their
gosh.
Arm. So they took the arm off the deck. And then they destroyed my suet cage. So now the latest thing we're doing, this is on the advice of the bird guy, you know, in the bird store. We got this pepper suet. So birds apparently can't taste it, but it'll keep mammals away. Mammals don't like it. So
like birds apparently can't taste it. We don't know
they,
sure.
We'll see.
Birds are like,
they eat it.
They
eat it.
So it's like pepper,
they don't have
like jalapeno pepper, or like black
yeah.
pepper.
Yeah.
Like jalapeno.
Like jalapeno. Yeah. They don't have the receptors.
Yeah. I've heard that about jalapeno water that you mm-hmm. could spray it to keep certain animals away.
From, oh, interesting.
Like, from your landscaping and stuff.
Yeah. Like deer. That's like deer. There's a deer mm-hmm. spray. If you have
yeah.
flowers or
does that
gardens,
work?
You know.
I don't know.
Oh, man.
Deer tend to go through everything, I think.
We have a deer problem in our backyard, too, because you mm-hmm. know, Kara, right? We live in the woods. I have
yeah,
to
you
say,
do.
I oh, think I it's do. So funny, but now that I've had a black bear on my deck, you kind of mm-hmm. have a point. You know, I can't really argue too much about the whole living in the woods thing when I have actual bear sighting in my backyard.
Yep.
But before I put some actual tall fencing around my garden, the deer would demolish it every year, and nothing, no deer repellent spray or whatever kept them away. Mm. They would eventually get hungry enough and they would just eat my garden.
Aww.
So now, but now it's fine. Now we got a fence up so they can't touch it. Now I got to worry about the damn rabbits because they're breeding like, you know, rabbits. But seriously, so I have, this is like half the reason why I have a dog is just to keep the critters out of my yard, right?
Yeah, he can't run anymore, the poor guy.
I know. He's got terrible arthritis in his back legs. I basically have to, like, carry him up and down the stairs.
Oh.
So he, you know, but he's not doing his job anymore of keeping the critters out of my yard. So, and I've definitely noticed, like, without him patrolling the yard, the chipmunks have taken over, the squirrels have taken over, and the rabbits have taken over. And it's hard keeping those guys out of my garden.
Okay,
they don't do that much damage.
Should you get a cat? Aren't cats better at that than dogs?
They're indoor. Because if you let the cats outdoor, then they will kill all the birds. You know,
oh,
so
the
I
birds
can't,
too. You yeah. like them. You want to keep the birds, but
keep
get
the birds.
Small mammals away. Yeah, it's a high,
this,
it's a high order.
Vermin.
This is where that Boston Dynamics dog, that robotic
yeah.
dog, would come in perfectly to patrol the backyard. You don't have to do anything, you know, as far as its legs going bad or anything else. Let
aww.
It do its thing and scare away nature. I like it.
I totally believe that robotic pets, they're already a thing, but they are going to be a huge thing. As soon as we can make a robotic pet that's like semi-practical, that, you know, it's cuddly and can mimic cat or dog level behavior and, you know, you could recharge it overnight. Why would you ever have a biological pet that will crap and pee in your house and
right.
tear up your
scratch
furniture?
Your
imagine
furniture.
If you could have a pet that you could program its behavior to do exactly what you want. And then once you get that, think about all the tech you could build into your robotic
okay,
pet.
Forget it.
I would 100% have a robotic pet. If
but I don't like my dog because he's
stuff.
A Swiss Army knife of skills.
I
like my dog
that's
because
what I
of
want.
His personality.
Yeah, but you can program a personality into a robot. That's, I'm sure dogs are not a sophisticated algorithm. Come on. We will crack the AI level of dogs before we could, you know, get to the point where we have a decent robotic pet.
Agreed.
Oh my God.
Steve, it sounds like you need a robotic sentry guarding your food from the damage.
That's what I want. I want raccoons. Yes. Well, think about it. You could have a pet. You could have a pet that is. You could have Bluetooth, right? First of all,
oh, absolutely.
It could be your smoke alarm, your alarm system, your nanny cam.
Yep. Night vision. You can use it.
Night
for.
Vision.
Obviously, it'll have cameras all over it.
Patrol your garden. Keep
can
bears
it, can it make
away.
Make coffee at night.
Absolutely.
Nice. That is the one thing Keurig
doesn't do. It has a Keurig built
do.
Into it, Rob. And
I would love that.
You could download your email. I mean, whatever. It could do whatever you want.
And you can project your voice through it. You're talking to a microphone, and it sounds like the animal is then speaking. In case you really need to scare something away. Hey, get away from that.
Bob,
bark, bark, bark.
I ask my dog every morning to make me a cup of coffee, and he refuses every morning. Does yours do
oh,
the same
bastard.
Thing? It's like well, so
I told
depressing.
You, my dog can't walk, so no, he's
not making coffee. It's coffee making days are done.
But yeah, robotic dogs—they are the future.
They are.
I
the,
want real dogs. No. I'll be a purist. I'll be like that.
I will ditch the biological pets the moment it's practical.
Please. Do you think we're going to have real pets on the moon when we colonize? No, there will be robotic pets. Most
yeah, but
certainly.
I'm not living on the moon either.
Well, you're
stay
not
here
you,
on Earth with my
I'll
flesh dog.
I'll go on vacation
dog.
There, though.
Yeah, until you get arthritis and somebody has to carry you around. You're like, wow, 1/6 G?
Right.
Yeah, I could go for 1/6 G.
Any day of the week.
That'll be your retirement colony on
yeah,
the
moon. Yeah, the moon colony.
Definitely. It'll be like the new Florida. The moon. Yeah. The new Florida.
Right.
Lunar hills. Right?
You could do low G like flying. You could strap on some cheesy wings and you could literally fly.
Dusty meadows.
Regolithic meadows.
Yes. Thank you.
Regolith Farms.
Pepperidge Farms.
Oh, Pepperidge God. Farms? Like the food?
My grandma used to walk on the moon.
I actually had a friend whose grandma lived in a retirement community, and I just looked it up. It still exists, called Leisure World.
Leisure World.
Isn't that the best name ever?
Leisure World.
Can I go visit Grams in Leisure World? I want to move to Leisure. It actually looks really nice.
Sure.
Floating recumbent chairs and
it's
sipping
amazing.
Drinks all day.
You know, I talked about having a robotic pet for kids, but also if you're an elderly adult, think about how much more independent you could be if you had a robotic pet. Right?
Have an assistant like that? Sure.
Yeah, think about it. So by the time we're old and decrepit, I'm hoping that, you know, we'll have totally driverless cars. So I'll still, you know, be independent mobility wise. We'll have robotic pets, right? We'll have fully functional prosthetic robotic limbs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Great.
Yeah.
And also, I'm hoping for the anti-aging sarcophagus from Stargate.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to make it that long, but I'll settle for the robotic legs, you know, and the self-driving cars.
And we'll have better, like, personalized medicine, too. Yeah, we'll be able to, you know, use some sort of scanner on our smartphone and send our doctor information. And
when you think about how much money we spend on nursing homes, it's actually cost-effective to keep elderly people in the home as long as possible.
Oh, sure.
So, having some tech, you could spend $20,000 on tech to keep them at home. That's cost effective.
Oh, are you kidding?
That's a huge savings.
Oh, my gosh. People spend that sometimes in like a month and a half in an elderly home. I kid you not.
Yeah, between healthcare, between just things like preparing meals, you know, the things that you think that a home healthcare aide has to help with. If robots could take a lot of that stuff over. Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Yeah. So I got to keep functional for like 25 years.
Yeah.
And hopefully by then.
Yeah, you know, 5 to 10.
The technology will be in place 5 to 10 years. You got a little bit more of a buffer, Kara, but for the three of us, we're like 25 years from having some serious issues.
Don't want to think about it.
At least right now, our knees still work, you know. All right, Kara. Yep. What do you know?
Ooh.
What do you know? What do you guys know? I read a really cool article that I might unpack only for a couple seconds, all maybe a couple minutes. But the what do you know at the end of this article is that rock doves, which is a bird.
Yep.
You know this.
Pigeon to the roofs. Yeah.
And carp, which is a fish.
Yep.
Are able to judge whether music was composed in the time of Bach or the time of Stravinsky.
Really?
Whoa. They can discriminate between 18th century classical music and 20th century classical music, something that a lot of people can't do.
I being among them.
Pretty cool, but of course it takes a lot of unpacking. There's a really great article right now, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, all about music perception in animals. And it starts with a conversation about the difference between perfect pitch and relative pitch. Do you guys know the difference between those two things?
I think so, yeah.
Stab at it.
Well, perfect pitch, you can hear one isolated note and tell precisely what it is, whereas relative pitch, which you comparing two, you could tell what they are, but you need two data points at least.
Yeah, so if we look at it of more of like a gestalt of perfect pitch and relative pitch, think about the way that human beings perceive music. We, for example, would hear twinkle, twinkle, little star. Or we would hear, twinkle, twinkle, little star. And we know it's the same song, even though it's a completely different key that we just sang it in. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we tried to use an AI to determine between those things, it's actually really complicated. We can program them to do it, but it's difficult. It's the reason that, for example, you guys have used that app on your phone where if you're in a restaurant or at a public place and you hear a song and you're like, dang, who sings this song? You can just hold it up and it'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's listening to a database of like all the recorded music. But if you try to sing into it, it's like, I don't know what you're doing because it's not recognizing the song. It's not recognizing the relative pitch. It's recognizing the actual physical absolute tones that were recorded. The relative pitch is a lot more complicated algorithmically. And for a long time, people didn't think that animals had relative pitch. They thought that that was a very special human capability, that it's hard to say if it preceded language, if it came after language. But many evolutionary biologists, even as early as Darwin, thought that our musical sensibility was actually fundamental to our language capabilities. You know, we talk a lot about prosody of language, which is more of a right hemisphere function. Syntax would be more of a left hemisphere function. But prosody is kind of like the emotional part of the language, the way that the musicality of the language. And we think that those things are deeply, inextricably linked from an evolutionary perspective. And the question is, do other mammals share that with us? And for a long time, scientists have set up experiments that just failed and failed and failed. And they were like, listen, like we know dogs, for example, can hear independent tones. That's how Pavlov trained his dogs. They were based on different tones. But we don't know that they understand the relationship between those tones the way that we do in music. But later, more complicated research started to take place, especially with birds, Steve, you know, because we know about songbirds and we know that there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with the brains of songbirds. But we still are a little bit confused about whether or not songbirds understand relative pitch versus absolute pitch. And it does seem to be the case that musical perception in animals across the board have much more to do with individual components of music as opposed to kind of the gestalt, which is how we recognize music. So a perfect example of that they use in the article is this conversation about an AI to determine airplanes in photographs. Right. You ask that's the CAPTCHA now, isn't it? You guys have seen these CAPTCHAs. Mm-hmm. Can't say that word. Where it's like, pick all the pictures with a car in it.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Like a computer can't do that yet. So you say, pick all the pictures with an airplane in it. People are like, yeah, that's obviously an airplane. And a computer's like, it's metal against blue. I don't know. Or, oh, gosh, is it a wing or is it a hot dog? I don't know. but apparently a very easy way to program that into an AI is to just say, OK, most planes have nose cones. Just look for a nose cone. When you try to give them all these different components and see the gestalt, they can't do it because there are too many, what would you call them, like exceptions to the rule. But if you pick out one little component and you say, can you pick that? A computer can do it pretty well. Seems to be that animals, for example, can do that as well. So a lot of the more complicated stuff that we think that animals can perceive in terms of music is actually that they can home in on one very simple thing within the music, and that's what they hear. So it might be specific tones, it might be a relationship between one tone and another tone, but the full spectrum, including things like prosody and timbre and color and contour and pitch, doesn't seem to be something that, at least so far in experiments, animals have been able to do. But of course, that brings us to the very end of the article where they talk about these very, I guess, perceptive fish and birds and their capabilities to distinguish between different types of classical music. One example was this great experiment where they played Bach and John Lee Hooker. Bach obviously being a classical style of music and John Lee Hooker being a blues style of music. And even when they were played through the same instrument with the same timbre, they could tell the difference. These koi fish could tell the difference between those compositions. And so it did seem to be that it had something to do with the relationship between not just rhythm, not just tone, not just these things, but there's something within the gestalt that they're able to pick out. And we're still trying to figure out what that is. So,
I mean, what humans are really good at is recognizing patterns, mm-hmm. but also abstract patterns so mm-hmm. that we can still recognize variations on a theme. That's why you can recognize the letter P in 1,000 different fonts, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's still the letter P, even though there's so many different variations, whereas that's what AI still has a really hard time doing. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting question, to, you know, to what extent animals can do that. And the answer always seems to be that you know, animals basically can, you know, at least some animals can do what humans do, just not as well, you know.
Yeah.
But there isn't anything that is absolutely uniquely human, because we are animals, and you know, they are on the same evolutionary continuum, you know.
Yeah, I think the question with music really comes into the same question that we have about language, because we know that animals communicate, and we know that animals oftentimes have very sophisticated communication, but they don't have the thing that we define as language. And so what is it that makes humans, or made humans, capable of developing this sophisticated, complicated thing that in many ways some people hypothesize set us on a cognitive sort of springboard?
God, yeah.
Yeah, that animals just simply don't have. Are they capable of it? Where are their brains the same as ours but different than ours? And music is one of those things that kind of seems to fit into the language conversation in a really complicated way. Some people, again, think that music is pre-lingual, and some people think that music came from language. Obviously, we'll probably never truly know, but it is an interesting thing to think about those kinds of topics and to study the way that our brains work and that relationship between the two.
All right, Bob, tell us how we are going to use black holes to travel close to the speed of light, or maybe aliens are doing it already.
What? So yeah, this really grabbed me. So yeah, so advanced aliens and our descendants may be cruising through the Milky Way in planet-sized spaceships at a significant fraction of the speed of light, by using lasers and stealing energy from black holes. So yeah, you heard that right. This is due to David Kipping. He's an astronomer at New York's Columbia University, and he posted his theory on the Preprint Archive server online. In it, he describes his fantastic and plausible variation on a common maneuver that our spacecraft do all the time, a gravitational assist, or a slingshot, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. It's used to speed up or slow down or change direction or combinations of those things. The whole idea of traveling at relativistic speeds, that's not really the most amazing thing about Kipping's idea. There's a lot of theories how that can be done. What's amazing is the possibility of moving an immense mass at that velocity. That's something that you only really hear about in science fiction, because it's really just not really a feasible thing in so many ways. And on top of that, the little extra icing on the cake is that he's saying that this could be essentially done with no fuel at all. And at that point, he really, really had my attention. So one thing that isn't generally, I think, well appreciated is the idea of how much fuel spaceships would need to travel light years. And it really is just totally nuts. And depending how you look at it, it doesn't even matter what kind of fuel. Any system you can envision eventually will require just insane amounts. You know, chemical fuel is the worst, obviously. Chemical energy, sure, it's significant, but in terms of sending a lot of mass, a lot of distance, there's really just not enough energy density in there. So, for example, if you would send a toothpick to Alpha Centauri in 100 years, how much chemical fuel, you know, typical classic chemical fuel would you need to do that? There's actually not enough fuel in the known universe to do that. You could not use chemical fuel to send a toothpick to the closest stellar system to our sun in a century. And the number that I got, I didn't even want to mention, and it's from Scientific American, so I think I could trust it, but they were saying that they calculated that it would be 10 to the 2200 times mass of the observable universe. I mean, it's just amazing. So that's one example. And so then people say, well, what about a matter antimatter annihilation engine? That's a near perfect conversion of energy. It's, you know, it's so efficient. Okay. So say you're going to the Andromeda Galaxy. the biggest, you know, spiral galaxy to our galaxy. Sure, it's really far away, but it's a matter antimatter annihilation engine. You would still need 4.2 billion tons of antimatter. 4.2 billion tons of antimatter. So the fuel, am I beating a dead horse here? You need a lot of fuel to go really far in space. I don't care what kind of engine you even have. So the idea that this guy came up with requiring no fuel is just blowing my mind. So let's talk about his idea, his theory here. So to understand his theory, you got to understand a little bit more detail about what a gravity assist is and how a gravity assist works. So Kipping's idea is based on something that I think all space exploration enthusiasts have heard of, this idea of the slingshot gravity assist maneuver. So this is when a spacecraft does a close flyby of a planet, say to speed up or slow down or to change direction. So this works not specifically due to the gravity of the planet that you're using. So if you think about it, as the spaceship gets closer to the planet, the gravity pulls it in faster and you go faster and faster. But then as the ship pulls away, the gravity is going to slow you down as it's trying to pull you back to the planet. So it's basically a wash. So how does a gravitational, you know, how does a gravity assist work?
Magic?
Yes, that magic is science. It's orbital mechanics. If you do the planetary flyby as the planet is moving away from you in its normal orbit around the sun, the spaceship will actually steal some of the planet's kinetic energy, its orbital energy. And that's the energy that you want when you're doing a gravity assist.
And so Bob, does that slow down the rotation of the planet?
It slows down the orbit of the planet, but minuscule. It's like the planet is so massive, it's negligible. So what if the ship does this with a much more massive object? I mean, really much more massive, like a white dwarf or a neutron star. This is exactly what Freeman Dyson suggested in the 1960s. He calculated that using this Dyson slingshot idea, as it's called, relativistic speeds could be achieved. So there's a big problem, though, is that the tidal forces that are involved with the neutron star or white dwarf and even the radiation that could be in the vicinity could likely destroy the ship. So that's generally not considered to be a great way to do this. And you'd also probably have to deal with some gravitational time dilation as well, which can be annoying, trust me. So here's where Kipling's idea comes in. He combines this gravitational or Dyson slingshot method with directed energy light sails. But a light sail, you know what a light sail is? It's a spaceship that has a sail that actually is pushed by the momentum, the pressure of photons of light. Directed energy light sails are designed to not use plain old photons, but laser, coherent laser light to get much greater acceleration. So he's kind of combining these two things. We actually have plans to use directed energy light sails to accelerate a probe or a tiny little spacecraft on the order of like a gram. You couldn't be much heavier because otherwise it would just take way too much energy. So the idea is to shoot lasers at a static binary black holes.
Lasers.
So you would think that wouldn't – what's a laser going to do to a black hole? But it could also be a particle beam, and you could also do it with a single black hole if you wanted. But the study focuses primarily on compact binary black holes. This is the way that you could potentially get the biggest payoff. And so this is what the study focuses on. The laser's photons are shot into a special boomerang orbit that brings them around the black hole or black holes and back directly to the solar sails of the spaceship. Some people call this a gravitational mirror for obvious reasons. The gravitational assist can't make the laser light faster, duh, but it can blue shift it and making it more energetic. Kipping says, kinetic energy from the black hole is transferred to the beam of light as a blue shift, and upon entering and upon return, the recycled photons not only accelerate, but also add energy to the spacecraft. So this is what he calls a halo engine. So do you get that? You're taking this idea of a gravitational assist, but you're using light, and you're stealing some of the kinetic energy from the movement of the orbiting black holes, and you're transferring a tiny bit of that to the light, to the laser light that then comes back, and you could harvest that extra energetic light from the laser that you sent out. So that's the basic idea of this halo engine.
How much more energetic is the light when at the end of this process?
I mean,
we must be talking.
It depends on lots of different variables, but enough that you could accelerate yourself to relativistic speeds. And we're talking if your spaceship, he claims, if your spaceship is as, you know, as massive as the Earth. The only restriction is that you need to be much less massive than the binary black holes. So that's a huge range of mass. And actually, you could accelerate yourself to a velocity that's 133% the velocity of the black holes using this method. So this means that planet-sized ships can travel at relativistic speeds. And that, to me, that just blows my mind. Imagine a Death Star-sized ship traveling at near light speed. The kinetic energy and the forces involved to do that are just amazing. But hey, that's the kind of energy you have contained in binary black holes. There's an estimated 10 billion black hole binaries in the Milky Way. 10 billion. So there could be many such highways crisscrossing our home galaxy now or to be used in the distant future. And that means that we could potentially use this information to find some sort of really advanced, you know, extraterrestrial civilizations or at least their technology. And imagine you could search for these lanes for evidence of advanced technologies that would use them. And Kipping used the idea of techno signatures. He calls these this evidence, techno signatures. So who knows? It'd be very difficult to find these techno signatures because there's not a lot of evidence that's being left. But one of the things that we can potentially find is that we could look for the binary black holes whose mutual orbits are decaying faster than they should because this energy is being tapped in this way. We'd have to find a bunch of them. Like, hey, here's a bunch of these black holes that are orbiting each other, and they're decaying way too fast. Maybe they're being used to propel these ships at relativistic speeds, which is a huge amount of energy that eventually would be noticed. So that's one possibility. So, of course, there are downsides. Can you think of some big downsides here?
You have to be near a black hole.
Yes, you have to get to the damn black hole in the first place. So it's kind of like carrying your boat to the river to take advantage of the swift current. Carrying that boat is a pain in the ass, especially if it's light years away. So you'd have to get there using some other type of engine. But the thing is, once you make that nasty investment, you could be pretty much set for millions of years taking advantage of that. But no, so what I love about this is this hope for super advanced technology. Warp drives or gate technology or faster than light travel. We've talked about that stuff. That's all probably bullshit. That's not going to happen. Just don't get your hopes up on any of that crap. We're not going to travel faster than light. And so here's a method that could potentially allow for huge spaceships to reach near light speed with literally no fuel. It's just amazing. It's amazing to contemplate the technology. And the fact that you wouldn't really even need any fuel once you have these systems set up. So it kind of, makes me feel a little bit better that we're probably never going to travel faster than light. So, all right. So now comes a little dose of reality. This hasn't been vetted. This is the preprint archive server. So I'm not aware of any other physicists that have checked out his equations. What do I know about relativistic equations? I mean, they look pretty good to me, but could be all gibberish for all I know. But that said, there doesn't seem to be anything in physics that would prevent this Halo Drive that Kipping is proposing. But he does make some assumptions, and perhaps some of those assumptions aren't warranted and could have a dramatic impact. So I'm definitely going to keep my eye out on this one to see what other people are saying. Another little wrinkle here, one final wrinkle, is that there's other uses. I mean, imagine this doesn't need to be used just for propelling amazing masses at relativistic speeds. You could use them, to decelerate incoming craft in a way that you're effectively storing energy in the binary, like a flywheel, basically turning this binary, these binary black holes into a cosmic battery. You could use it to pull energy out of it, to store energy that will keep for, a really long time. Black holes evaporate, but they're going to be around for many billions of millennia. So who knows what use will make of them, especially when entropy starts getting so high that we're like, oh my God, we need some energy. Where are we going to pull it from? All the stars have burned out. Well, we'll start pulling them from black holes if any intelligences are around at that time. So cool stuff. Check it out.
So yeah, just to clarify one thing, because Evan, I think you were asking about rotational energy, but Bob, you're talking about orbital momentum, right? So what's interesting is that if you want to speed up a spacecraft with a gravitational assist, essentially when you leave the planet, you have to be going more in the direction that the planet's going around the sun than when you entered it. And if you want to slow down, you go less in the direction of the way the planet's moving. And you can slow down a lot, right, if you leave the system going in the opposite direction that the planet's going around the sun. You could slow down a lot.
I love orbital mechanics.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
We talk about The Great Courses Plus on the show all the time, and that's because all of us are huge, huge, huge fans. That's because The Great Courses Plus offers us the opportunity to continue to learn even outside of an academic setting. I'm talking thousands of lectures on topics across the board, astronomy, biology, history, literature, even cooking. And my favorite part, you can watch or listen, kind of like in podcast form, entirely on your schedule from anywhere with unlimited access.
Right now, I'm loving the course by Professor Scott Solomon, What Darwin Didn't Know, The Modern Science of Evolution. It's just a great way to get you updated on evolutionary theory, because let's face it, you really learned squat in high school.
True.
But this course is great. Like, for example, there's a lecture on imperfect nature, ad hoc body designs, because we know evolution took place because of all the crazy crap that resulted, not because of perfect design, but because of the imperfect design. And that's just one of 24 really fascinating lectures about evolution.
And we want you to start enjoying The Great Courses Plus as well. Right now, you can enjoy a free trial with unlimited access to the entire library at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. So start that free trial today at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, here's a quick follow-up to the things that I've discussed previously, the correlation between drinking sugary drinks and heart disease. It's one of those things, like when I wrote about it, when I mentioned it, people are like, well, duh, yeah, of course, you know, drinking sugar is a, you know, a risk factor for heart disease. It's like, yeah, but what's interesting is that it actually is controversial. I think the biggest controversy is in low-calorie sweeteners, right? So is it more healthful to drink a sugar-sweetened drink like soda? Mm-hmm. Or something sweetened with aspartame or some other low-calorie sweetener, or water.
Water. Well,
I would guess water.
So there's no question that there's basically no downside to drinking water, right? Yeah. That's if you want to be absolutely sure that you are optimizing the healthfulness of your liquids, drink water, right?
Well, there is a downside. I mean, you could pull a Tycho Brahe and have your bladder person die from drinking too much water.
Yeah, you could overdo it and get water toxicity.
But that's not specific to water. If you did that with any of those liquids, that would happen.
That's true.
But what will you find in almost all those liquids? Water.
Water.
Dihydrogen monoxide. Damn you.
It'll kill you.
So this was a follow-up study, actually. So they've been following these cohorts. There's actually two databases they're following, one of men and one of women. There's a physician's registry and a nurse's registry, which I guess sounds a little dated and sexist, but that's the way it is. The physician's registry is following – it's a men's – male physician's registry, and then there's a female nurse's registry.
Wow.
Yeah. But whatever. It's all about gathering epidemiological data and an updated analysis of this data. Now we're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of individuals over many years – found a good correlation, a strong correlation between drinking sugar-sweetened drinks and the risk of premature death from heart disease. So, which is the exact same thing they found when they looked at the data in 2012. And so now we have, you know, I think there's like 4 more years of data because, you know, it takes time to analyze it and get published. And it showed the same thing. So it's basically holding up as they're gathering more data. Not something that you would think is, you know, would be that controversial to point out. But where it gets controversial is the whether or not it would be helpful to tell somebody, stop drinking that sugar-sweetened soda, and instead, if you insist on drinking something sweet, drink low-calorie sweetened, you know, diet soda, something that's sweetened by a low-calorie sweetener. So I've tried to keep as up to date on this literature as I can. I've written summaries about this on Science-Based Medicine. And what this new study shows is that when you look at the data in men, it shows no downside to the diet sweetened drinks. And there is absolutely an advantage over drinking sugar sweetened drinks. But in the female data, there was a trend if you had more than one per day of increased heart disease compared to water. It's still an advantage to sugar, but there may have been an increase relative to drinking water, but only if it was more than one per day and only in the women. And it was a trend. It was not statistically significant. And they said more research is necessary to confirm this because it's too preliminary. So it's basically a non-event, in my opinion. You know, it's like most of these preliminary needs more research, whatever. You could ignore those. Most of them are not going to pan out.
Yeah, but I do think it's important to remember, too, that like when we talk about these kinds of studies, we want them to be like relatable to people's actual choices and lifestyles. And there are a lot of people who drink a lot of soda. And I think we do have to remember that it's like, there are people who drink a six pack a day or more.
Yeah, but the data shows that if it's zero calorie, it's not a problem.
I thought you just said in women, if it's more than one, it can be a problem.
Well, but what I'm saying is that the data was not really significant and would need to be replicated. And in my book, that's basically nothing.
Oh, I didn't hear you say that it wasn't a significant difference.
Yeah, it was just a trend, you know. So it's like,
yeah, but maybe they didn't test those. Like, that's the question. Did they do that?
Well, this is all correlational. This is all correlational. This is all retrospective. They're looking at the data and they're just looking for correlations. So there's lots of different ways to address this question. This is why I'm saying I'm not concerned about that, partly because I've reviewed all the other research and it doesn't show anything. So I think that if you look at the entirety of the research, we could make a firm conclusion that you're definitely better off drinking diet drinks than sugar-sweetened drinks. And it's probably not different than drinking water. But we can't, you know, the confidence in that second conclusion that it's probably no different than just drinking straight water, there's a little bit of doubt remaining there. We haven't completely eliminated that, but that's the way the research is heading. It's kind of like the cell phone and cancer thing where it's like, yeah, the research is heading towards the conclusion that there's no correlation there, but we haven't fully, you know, ruled out a small correlation.
I remember reading years ago, Covert Bailey. About fitness, he's a molecular biologist. He did a lot of studies, and he was one of the first scientists that studied fit mice. He bought mice and made them fit, and then compared their reactions to certain things compared to regular sedentary mice. And for things like, I remember specifically, he would look at things like, say, sugar intake, which is related to what you're talking about. And he said that the fit mice shrugged off any of the negative side effects of, say, sugary drinks much more than, say, a regular mouse. So do they ever do studies like this and have a subgroup of people that are just fit and see how they react to this, or they just don't even care?
Well, that's the thing. This wasn't a study.
Well, yeah, but they could still look at the data and separate the people that are, if you have enough information, like, all right, this 10% of these people here are in the high, you know, are fitter. Yeah. And what's their results?
The fitter you are, the better your outcomes are going to be.
Across
the board. And the smaller the apparent effect of negative health effects, because they do tend to add together. You know, like if you take a double hit, like if you smoke and you have, you know, birth control pills, then your cardiovascular risk goes way up. Whereas either one alone, like the sum of the multiple risk factors is greater than the individual risk factors. Yeah. They do tend to have it.
Yeah.
And that's a real problem, I think, in general with the way that we do clinical experimentation. I mean, we're constrained by the fact that we want good, clean data, right? And it's really hard to get good, clean data when we're using a medical approach to understanding these things. Like, it's much easier to take a bunch of cloned mice and do something to some of them and don't do that to the other ones and see what happens. But when you're looking at people and they have all this variability, we often will try to get the cleanest data possible, which means that we will actually take samples that are not like representative of real people. And those are the only samples we really like to look at. We're like, well, we don't want any of the ones with comorbid problems, with diabetes, with psychological conditions. Like, we see this all the time in psychology studies. Like, for major depression, they'll leave out all the people who have comorbid diagnoses. And you're like, how many people have depression and not anxiety? It doesn't really represent reality.
Yeah, that gets to the efficacy versus effectiveness.
Yeah,
in the real world. You know, you want to control variables as much as possible, but then the applicability to the real world goes down. Or you look at the real world, but then you're not really controlling your variables as much. Or you do both, right? So that's – so right, because there's no studies perfect. It's all trade-offs. So with this question – low-calorie sweeteners versus sugar versus nothing sweet. If you there's animal data, there's experimental data, there's observational data of different types. The animal data shows all kinds of weird stuff that I just don't think is applicable to people, is the bottom line. If you look at – the experimental data is limited and, you know, it's hard to do it in – a lot of people. The observational data where we, you know, if you, once you get to the point where you're looking at lots of people, you're controlling for variables, but it's kind of a real world observation. We haven't seen any negative signal there with the diet, the low calorie sweeteners. You know what I mean?
And, what about psychological? Oh, because this is the one wrinkle to this. And I, it's a question that I've come across a lot when I'm reading about it. Yes, I think that when we look at the biological data, the clinical data, we don't see any difference in health effects, right?
Yeah.
But when we look at actual like obesity, like weight gain data, I was under the impression, and maybe this is not a trend in the data, maybe this is just a few, it's cherry picking. But I was under the impression that our cells, our actual cells look at sugar, real sugar and fake sugar differently. Like it actually affects insulin differently. We know this. That's why people with diabetes can eat things with fake sugar in them. But our brains, like our satiety signals and our psychological relationship with food doesn't.
So I don't think that's a real thing. And
really?
I'll tell you why.
Interesting.
So, because that's a hypothesis that comes out of the animal data.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
So that's a hypothesis they came up with to explain the funky stuff that happens in the
like
animal
why
data.
Are some animals still getting fat even though they're not
eating
sugar?
Why are these rats getting fat when we're feeding them? But it doesn't translate to people, so we don't have to hypothesize that with people. And so that hypothesis has never really been proven, and it really doesn't apply to people because it's not a phenomenon in people. If your obesity, your weight gain, your change in weight is all has to do with how many calories you consume, and this idea that if you drink sweet things with no calories, it'll make you eat more just hasn't panned out in people. We don't see that in the data. What you do see is a correlation between obesity and drinking diet drinks, but it is completely the other way. It's if you're overweight, that motivates you to drink low-calorie drinks.
Well, and you probably also see a correlation just in general between, whether it's that you're drinking low-calorie things because you think that they're better for you or whether because you're already overweight and you want to lose weight or, you know, you have some semblance of the fact that maybe this is somehow not going to make you that much more obese. But in general, you're just going to see that correlation anyway. People who are obese are going to be eating more grocery store food than more produce, for example. They're going to be eating more food out of boxes than out of produce. And like that's the problem with these health food industries in general is they take these massive correlations and then they say this directly leads to weight gain or weight loss.
Of course.
Well, there's a correlation between being overweight and being on a diet. That doesn't mean that being causes being overweight. It's the other way around. And that's what the data shows, basically. So, and the thing is, there's no question that zero-calorie sweetened drinks are better for you than sugar-sweetened drinks. The one thing that we're pretty certain about is that refined sugar is bad for you. That's the one thing we're absolutely sure about. I mean, obviously, it's always a matter of degree, a matter of amount. A little bit here and there is not a problem. But if you're drinking, as you say, like a 2 liters of sugar-sweetened soda a day, that is going to increase your risk of diabetes and of heart disease and of early death. And there's no question about that.
And it also depends on everything else you're doing. And that's the other thing. Like all these things correlate, right? I drink coffee every morning and there are 2 sugars in my coffee. And I don't want to live a life where I can't put 2 sugars in my coffee every morning. I just don't.
Bumps.
But I count my calories every day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm in a calorie deficit right now because I'm losing weight. I eat 1,250 calories a day. I've lost 8 pounds over 7 weeks. It's all
working.
It
doesn't matter if some of those, yeah, it doesn't matter if some of those calories are sugar.
Exactly. I don't want to live without that sugar, but I'm also not drinking a 2-liter bottle of soda.
Right. But think about it. So like an average, like a 12-ounce can of Coke has 140 calories. You drink a few of those a day, you could easily get up to, you know, you
should drink 700 calories.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and 72 ounces would be 840 calories a day. Could you imagine drinking 840
calories? That's almost my daily intake.
That's, and, yeah, right,
that drives me crazy. That just sounds so, I don't know, I can't relate to
that's
that.
That's like I'm one big kind of Coke person, at the.
Yeah, I'm the kind of person that, I do not drink calories. To me, drinking calories
seems like a waste.
It's a rare thing.
Yeah, but you like the taste of coffee. Like most, not most, some people can't drink straight coffee. It's too bitter.
Oh, I can't either. I mean, I throw three equal in my coffee.
You put the fake sweeteners. I don't like the way equal tastes. I think it tastes super weird. That's why I go for it.
You get used to it.
Yeah. Well, but if you had 800 calories of food, but either, the nutrition you can get from that, oh my gosh.
Right.
Well, that's the thing. Two sugars is only, by the way, 40 calories, I think?
Yeah, that's not that much.
It's not that much. That's not a big deal.
Two teaspoons. But here's the thing. Also, studies show over and over and over, and this has been replicated so many times, that people consistently underestimate their caloric intake by like 600 or 700 calories a day.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, easily.
I believe that.
All the grazing and snacking people do, they hardly count down any of that.
And they don't know.
Condiments on their food.
Condiments,
alone.
Yeah. They just don't know how much things are worth. Like when you actually start counting your calories and you're like, oh yeah, I just devoured a bag of almonds, but almonds are good for you. Yeah, they're also really high in calories.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're not good for you. You should eat almonds. Right. But when you eat a whole bag of almonds, you're consuming a ton of calories.
Yeah, a lot of fat, estimate too. Your calories.
Yeah.
A lot of fat.
Oh, absolutely. So no question, it's, you know, if, especially if you're weight conscious, if you're trying to contain your calories, not drinking sugar is a really good thing. If you want to avoid diabetes and obesity, not drinking refined sugar is a good thing. And, you know, you should not worry about the low-calorie sweeteners. If you like the way they taste, to me, they're fine. I actually prefer them to sugar. But if that's fine, you know, then there's no reason not to do it. It's actually much better for you. And yet, there are people, we were at Google, right? And Google had sugarcane, all natural sweetened drinks in their refrigerator, but no zero calorie, you know, sweetener drinks.
What about all their employees that are diabetic?
Well, water, right? Which is fine. Drink water, but some people don't like. I don't like drinking water with my meal. To be honest with you, I like drinking something that's a little sweet. But that's also what we're used to, which is fine. But the thing is that people were actually thinking that natural cane sugar sweetened soda was better for them than, say, equal sweetened drinks.
Ooh, and that's appeal to nature, pal.
Yeah. It's clearly not true. Mm-hmm. That is out there, right? That's the appeal to nature fallacy.
Yeah.
So anyway, but this study supports that. But it's also interesting because there was that one non-statistical trend that needs further research to follow up. And it's even after more years and more data, it's still not clearly being shown in the data. That's what some of the headlines went with.
Interesting. Of course. Yeah, of course. Because that's something to write about. Yeah, otherwise, it's
exactly.
They're not going to get anybody to read the article.
Yeah, not the real result, which was don't drink sugar sweetened drinks, and it's better for you to drink zero calorie sweetened drinks. Very frustrating.
Yeah.
All right, Kara, so how are we doing shocking people out of their depression?
Yeah. Okay, so I feel like I could talk about this for 5 hours or for 5 minutes.
I'm
going to try and do the 5-minute version. But if we look at this article that was actually recently published in Translational Psychiatry, it was this year, double-blind randomized pilot clinical trial targeting alpha oscillations with transcranial alternating current stimulation for the treatment of major depressive disorder. Okay, so if we start to parse that down, yes, it was a double-blind randomized clinical trial, but yes, it was also a pilot study. So there was only like 30 participants. So let's keep that in mind from the beginning. And it had three treatment groups. So we're talking 10 versus 10 versus 10. We're looking at something called transcranial alternating current stimulation in this study. You guys might have heard of TDCS. I think it's a little bit more popular. Yeah. I actually did a coverage of TDCS years ago on the show I used to work for Al Jazeera America called Techno. Probably you could look it up on YouTube and find a whole episode of the show where I'm like getting my brain zapped. Did nothing for me, by the way, but I know that's anecdotal. TDCS does seem to be the more popular thing. The only real difference between TDCS and TACS is that one's direct current stimulation, one's alternating current stimulation. So you guys know the difference?
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the actual wave, right? One of them alternates. Right. It's like it's a sinusoidal wave, and the other one is maintained. Direct. Yeah. And so, you know, what we're talking about is a non-invasive approach, which is why I think it's been so appealing to so many people for so long. It's cheap and easy to do. But because of that, there's a whole internet. None of this is covered in the article, by the way, but there's a whole internet hacking culture that's like, I'm going to do TDCS or TACS to my own head. And it's like, maybe not a good idea. And they'll do things like plug it into the wall. Don't do that. Yeah, definitely. What? Like, you want to use like a 9-volt or smaller battery. So yeah, there's a lot of like concern here. They looked at three different groups, a 10 hertz group, a 40 hertz group, and a sham group. And they gave them TACS. All of the people had depression. They got rid of, not, they didn't get rid of, they didn't kill anybody, but they didn't include anybody in the study that had like other stuff, like kind of what we talked about before, not really representative of how most people struggle with mental illness, like clean depression, whatever that is. It was a pilot. It was like, yeah, basically, are they going to get hurt? Because they talk a lot about side effects in it. So I think they're just trying to say, is it safe enough to try this in the future? Good news, no side effects. Okay, but nobody really expected side effects, I don't think. So, but it's very hard to control something like that. They tried, I think, their basic control on this was they had all been on their antidepressants for at least 6 weeks.
Yeah,
and they were stable on them. Yeah, so any difference that we see is probably due to this treatment and not to what they were already on. I think it was longer for Prozac or whichever one has like a super long half-life. And so the idea here is that there are alpha oscillations that are different between your left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and your right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And this has been seen in depression in the past. The question here is, though, is depression because of these differences? Probably not. Does this just happen to happen in depression? Probably.
Yeah, just a marker.
Just a whole bunch of other stuff happened in depression. Mm-hmm. So I've never fully understood this approach of like, let's look at somebody who has an issue. Let's look at one little thing that we know about their brains because, or not because of, but that's associated with that issue. And let's try to reverse that thing and see if it actually solves the issue. There is no theoretical reason to think that these oscillations are the cause of depression. Not that I can come up with. What about you, Steve?
No, I agree. I think I've always been skeptical of this whole approach. Like, let's look at the brain waves and then make the brain waves look like the condition we want.
Yeah, and then like, maybe the people won't have depression anymore.
Brain waves aren't driving the condition. It's the other way around, if
exactly.
anything.
Exactly. And what do we expect from this? They find some really not too surprising outcomes. Very, very little, very few significant differences. Very few. And it really bothers me that they only found, they ran so many post-hoc analyses that I'm not surprised that they found significant differences in like some random things. So, and also I worry about their hypothesis in this study. Why did they hypothesize that the 10 hertz treatment group would be the treatment group, but the 40 hertz wouldn't, and that the sham would be the control? I don't know. I might think 40 hertz is better than 10 hertz. 10 hertz is good. Right. 40 hertz is better. But their hypothesis was that the 10 hertz group would have the positive outcome. But they don't classify, they don't make an argument for that anywhere in the paper. They just say that's our hypothesis. And I'm like, is that a post-hoc hypothesis? I don't know. So I don't want to, you know, say that they're doing that. I don't know, but it is a strange thing that they don't give a rationale for that.
Yeah.
So they find that the 10 hertz group actually, after this treatment, only at the 2-week marker, not at the 4 weeks.
Seems random. Yeah.
Seems random. Yeah. Showed a difference compared to the 40 hertz and the sham group, who showed no difference. That's weird. They also didn't find any positive therapeutic. Like, they did, you know, two different things. They did the TACS, and I won't get into how they did it, but you can look up how to do TACS online. And then they looked at EEG data to look at the brain waves after the fact. Oh, and we didn't even talk about what alpha waves are. You guys know about alpha waves? These are like, what, daydreaming? Yeah. What are some other
things? It's like the resting rhythm before beta waves. The cortex, yeah.
So it's like this kind of background rhythm. What is it like?
When your eyes closed and you're awake, basically.
Yeah, eyes closed, awake, daydreaming, like the chillax brain waves. But these random outcomes that they found in this study feel very arbitrary. I don't understand how they fit the model of the data, or how they fit the model of the hypothesis at all. I don't really understand how they theoretically, how they drive theory at all. And that sort of bothers me because I do think that experimental data, it generally speaking in science, you have an observation and you develop a hypothesis based on that observation, and then you develop experiments to try to interrogate nature in some way or another to understand it, and then you start to iterate and iterate and iterate. But the theory, right, these ideas that we take from them are evolving as we go, and theory usually drives data. It's not that you shoot a bunch of darts at a dartboard and then walk up and sharpshooter fallacy them and circle the things that were abnormal. Sometimes that's the case in certain fields of science, but especially I think in clinical science, it's a very dangerous approach to go that way and backward negotiate the data to come up with some sort of clinical strategy. And I'm a little bit, worried that that's what's going on in this study. It's sort of like we just want to rationalize why it could be important to do future studies, which is fine.
As long as you recognize that's what it is.
Yeah, but what I don't like are the press releases.
I know. I agree. This is a preliminary study. It's hypothesis generating, not hypothesis testing. And the press releases are totally overselling the results.
But the thing is, they're pulling quotes from the lead researcher in the press release. He said, we conducted a small study of 32 people because this sort of approach had never been done before. Great. Love it so far. And then they quote him, now that we've documented how this kind of TAC...
Documented. Write it
Thank
down.
You.
Documented.
Click, 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 click.
I love it.
Now that we've documented how this kind of TACS can reduce depression symptoms, I don't see any documentation of that. We can fine-tune our approach to help many people in a relatively inexpensive, non-invasive way. Those are major claims. Yeah. This isn't just about fine-tuning,
not supported by the data. Yeah.
Nope.
But so let me back up a little bit. So okay. I think, this is preliminary data. You can't make too much out of it.
Yeah. He's backing up.
But,
I thought you were quacking, Bob.
Yeah. Is that what you're trying to do, Bob?
That's much better. Thank you.
All right. So I like the idea of using some version of electrical or magnetic stimulation in order to affect brain function. And I think that we are at the beginning, the dawn of this new therapeutic modality. But what's interesting is how disappointing the therapeutic effects have actually been.
Absolutely.
They're really teeny tiny to non-existent so far.
We're also really not at the dawn, because if you look back, I mean, we're at the dawn, I think, of focusing it, right?
Yeah.
Of like honing it. But this stuff goes back to like Volta. It goes back to, who is the Vitalist guy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm talking about like actual neurology, like actual
therapeutic
interventions.
No, I know, but the Vitalist guy, the one who like, oh God, what was his name?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Galvani.
Yeah, Galvani.
Yeah.
They did this on themselves and were like, I feel less melancholia. Like,
oh, yeah. Just shocking the head in order to treat depression is very old. Yeah, absolutely. But I'm talking about, we're entering a new age, though. We're going beyond just like the very crude, just let's just shock the head, to let's use specific frequencies, focus to specific depths, you know, at over durations, specific anatomical structures to try to alter brain function. Not just, let's just shock the head and, you know, get a non-specific effect. And I think there's great potential here, but it's turning out to be a lot harder than we thought to get real therapeutic effects. For research, it's already a great tool.
This is used a lot in research.
Yeah, because you could use big machines and turn on and off different parts of the brain. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but TMS is really good for that.
Yeah, therapeutic effects, they've been underwhelming so far, but I do think there's tremendous potential here. But what I don't know is whether or not we're going to really be seeing solid therapeutic effects in 5 to 10 years or 20 to 50 years.
And is the mechanism of action and how – I think it's interesting. I interviewed a guy who was a TDCS researcher. Yeah. So, of course, his life's work is dedicated to TDCS. And he's seen all sorts of cool stuff in the research lab. And I was like, you know, it kind of seems like snake oil, because every time you read about it, people are like, it does everything. It cures Parkinson's. It cures Alzheimer's. It helps with pain. It helps with depression.
And you're like – Nice barker voice.
But doesn't
there.
That yeah. sound like snake it. Oil? And he was like, I get it. Listen, I'm a scientist. Like, of course that sounds like snake oil. The minute that something is multi-use, it becomes problem. Like, anytime you're like, it's a panacea, it's like, yeah, okay, that's kind of off-putting.
All right, but here's the thing. I agree, but here's the thing.
But here's the difference. Yeah, go ahead.
The thing is, the brain's an electrical organ. And manipulating its electrical function should have multiple uses. It's kind of mm-hmm. like saying, oh yeah, drugs can cure everything. Yeah, different drugs for different purposes. This is a category of treatments, not one treatment.
And right? This is like pharmacology. Depends on its placement.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we still need to figure out. Now, like, we've hit upon the idea of using chemicals as drugs. Uh-huh. Now we have to figure which drug for which indication, which dose, and all that stuff. So that's where we're at. I think right now with it.
I can't wait till we have the brain sense. All figured
right?
out.
Yeah. 5 to 10 years, Bob.
Yeah, Most complex thing in the universe. Got it.
Got
Check
it.
That box.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, LinkedIn.
Hey, guys, when it's time to make a hire for your small business, you want to find the best person for the job. Odds are that person is on LinkedIn. LinkedIn Jobs makes it easy to get matched with quality candidates using knowledge of both hard skills and soft skills to match you with the people who fit your role the best.
So here's how it works, you guys. When you use LinkedIn Jobs to hire somebody, you get these matches, and they're based on a lot more than just a resume. They're based on skills, background, but also things like interests, activities, and passions. And because of that, this matching lets you get a group of the most relevant, qualified candidates for your role so that you can focus on those candidates and you can really, you know, dig into these quality hires instead of just sifting through thousands of documents.
So post a job today at linkedin.com/skeptics and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/skeptics. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Evan, why did this woman inject herself with stuff? Tell us what happened.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah.
This is the dumbest thing of the week, Evan. Yes, you sent me this. Yeah. The dumbest thing of
it
the week.
It is.
Yep. This will be the dumbest thing of the week. Let's head halfway around the world to China, and it's being reported in the South China Post Online, where a Chinese woman narrowly escaped death after inserting into her veins a homemade IV drip containing fruit juice. Mm-hmm. Yep, intravenous pseudoscience. I don't know that we've ever covered something along this line.
Yeah, turmeric. Before. You remember the turmeric infusion?
Oh, was it an IV?
Yeah.
She did not fare well, unfortunately.
She died.
Yep.
Ugh.
Yep.
Gosh. So the woman who, fortunately, they rushed her to the hospital in time. They saved her life. But she was in severe shutdown of her kidneys were shutting down. Her liver was affected. Her heart as well. I mean, she really messed herself up badly by doing this.
Wait. So did she make her own? Because in the turmeric one, like she went to some naturopath and they bought like
naturopath
a bag.
Did it, yeah.
Yeah, the naturopath did it. And it was like some sort of, I mean, it wasn't healthy, obviously, but I guess there was some lab somewhere that made an IV, obviously not FDA approved. This lady make her own infusion?
Yep.
That's exactly what she did. And she said, I thought fresh fruits were very nutritious and it would not do me harm by injecting them into my body.
Wait, you can't inject water into your body. She knows this, right?
I mean, this goes to really a different level than in which you get into a mindset in which you think that injecting anything without a doctor's approval into your body would be something good.
Well, how do you know how to do an IV if you don't know enough basic biology to know that you can't mainline apple juice? That's
and
a
why
weird
why wouldn't
thing
she
to me.
Just drink the juice?
I know.
Right. Because I suppose it doesn't explain. The article doesn't
Well, it's because it's a
her,
fad.
Her
because,
mindset behind it.
Because
right.
the IV drips for hydration and vitamins is kind of a fad. That's why.
Yeah, but they're not just apple juice in an IV bag.
I know. This is taking it to a new level, which is why it's the dumbest thing of the week.
She used 20 different types of fruit in her concoction.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so she Vitamixed that stuff.
Yeah, not that it matters.
That's right. Not that it matters.
Not that it
probably
matters.
Probably very
so
tasty.
So she felt itchy for a little while, but then her temperature rose, but she figured, okay, I'm just getting a little sick or whatever. But then, like, the next night, her discomfort got so bad that was it. They had to call the ambulance and send her right to intensive care.
She went a whole day with it? Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. She must have put herself into shock.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Doctors were able to clean her blood using dialysis, injecting clotting agents, and gave her antibiotics.
Did she have any kidney damage from this?
Yeah, kidney and liver.
Yikes.
Yes, kidney and liver damage.
Yikes.
Yep.
Like lasting. Yep. Is she going to have to be on dialysis in the future?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Didn't say.
Don't know.
But
yeah,
could be. I mean, she could have done that to herself.
She's lucky she's alive.
I know.
That's a coin flip.
I mean, really, she maybe a few more hours and that would not be would not be the case here.
I just have so many questions because it's like her IV, the fruits and vegetables, there's no way they were sterile.
That's right. That's the point.
Second, well, did she, well, it's not the only thing. I mean, did she strain them? How watery was this concoction that she, like, did it have pulp? Was it pulp free?
Right. How did you account for all the, for how, how liquefied was it?
Like, how did she not end up with an embolism?
How did her husband not stop her from doing this? Her husband was apparently around.
Maybe their marriage isn't going well.
Oh, my. Yeah, it's like, sure thing, babe.
Hey,
seems
honey,
like a great idea.
I heartily endorse this plan.
Did she Google this? I mean, just like, hey, maybe I'll Google this before I do an IV drip to myself.
And also, maybe she's a nurse.
She's a pioneer, Bob.
Does she have any healthcare experience? Like, I would not know how to start a line.
Yeah.
Would you, like, Evan, would you know how to put an IV in?
I would.
Not without instruction. No, yeah, but I'm sure you could YouTube it and they'll show you.
Oh, my gosh.
You can find practically instructions for anything on YouTube or whatever the Chinese equivalent that they have access to. And, you know, of course, you know, social media gets a hold of this and people have comments and stuff. And there are people rooting her on and admiring her courage as well as her intelligence. I mean, so it sort of takes on a life of its own. And, you know, you wonder if someday there's going to be some kind of copycat to this, you know, despite her brush with death. They're going to try it anyways. Oh, it didn't work for her. Something like this would work for me.
Yeah, I'll just put some antibiotic in the bag and I'll be fine.
Just wild. Oh, I mean, to go to that extent, you know, eat your vegetables, folks, you know.
Yeah, eat your food. Don't shove it up your butt. Don't IV it.
Don't roll around in
don't
it.
Don't snort it either.
Yeah, just eat
and
it.
Swallow.
Don't definitely
it
don't do that. Don't put garlic in your ear. Women, don't put anything, you know.
Don't put jade eggs up your hoo-ha.
Nope.
Right.
Yeah, don't try to eat your food through your vagina. That won't work for anyone.
Yeah. Oh, you heard about that story. Well, there's tangents and there's
other
stories
I found. Learn what your different orifices are for and use them correctly.
But I thought that South Park was a documentary series.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember that whole thing where they were like ate their turkey dinner up their butts and then they pooped out? That was such a good episode. Oh, Martha Stewart.
All right. Dumbest thing of the week. That took the cake.
Thank you, Evan.
It had to win. Yeah. There you are.
No Who's That Noisy this week, because Jay's not here. We'll get caught up next week. So we'll move on to a couple of questions and emails. Bob, so some people were confused about your atomic clock and GPS piece last week. We had a number of questions. People were like, well, how does the super accurate clock obviate the need for the GPS satellites? They didn't get that.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't mean to imply that a portable, hyper-accurate clock is all you need to navigate without GPS. That was kind of in all the research that I read about it. That was kind of like the throwaway line that they had was that having this portable atomic clock could give you an extremely accurate form of geo mapping that would let you plan out, have a route planned out. Without the need for the satellite. But I think it's all about inertial navigation systems. And we have them today. We have them now. So the idea then, I think, is that you have this portable, extremely accurate atomic clock, but you also need other things with it, like, say, a three-axis gyroscope, a three-axis accelerometer. And if they are also very accurate, then I think together you would have a system that could obviate the need for GPS.
You could have theoretically in a car.
Exactly. You have that in a car. Mm. And I mean, they've got systems like that for subs and for ships and things. You know, they have those. But if you have, they have a certain level of accuracy, then the errors won't mount up, right? Because even if you're off by just a little bit, And it, very quickly, you know, you would be completely lost. So if they're all extremely accurate, if your gyroscope, your accelerometer, and atomic clock are very accurate, then you would, it would know specifically, the, you know, the, how fast you're accelerating, the direction, you know, your orientation, yeah. And it could time it all precisely with the atomic clock. And so you really wouldn't need the GPS if you had all of that working together in your inertial navigation system. Now, of course, you would need to know, like, your starting point. You would, you know, you would need to know that, and it would be helpful to know precisely where you are, some sort of coordinate system. But it could be as simple as, okay, I'm at the edge of my driveway, and you start there. And then, if everything was working together properly, you could potentially, over a long period of time, you could map out precisely where you're going without relying on the satellites to perfectly pinpoint yourself on the planet, on the surface. You could use this inertial navigation system, including a very accurate master timing clock.
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody else's GPS, like, really crap right now? Apple Maps right now is like a hot mess right now, at least for me when I'm driving around.
Mine was working fine. Yesterday, that's, when I went on
yeah,
a trip.
Yeah, I'm using the Google one. I'm okay.
I feel like I need to go back. I went to Apple for because it was like better for a while, and now I'm wondering if they didn't do that update, that polar update
or something.
Yeah, like, because I'm literally blocks away oftentimes from where it thinks I am.
That's not
good. It's like whole streets away, and I'm driving parallel to where the arrow is, and it's constant. It's like telling me to exit to get back on the freeway that I'm already on. It's like amazing.
It's supposed to be accurate within like 20 feet or so.
Supposed
to be.
No, this is hundreds and hundreds of feet.
Something's way out of whack.
Frustrating.
There.
Come on, Apple.
But yeah, the news item basically that we're updating was the ability to create really small atomic clocks. And so that opens up new possibilities, you know, where you, if you could, if they could be portable, they could be in your car theoretically. And then, you could.
Or your back pocket.
Or your back pocket even. Yeah. If they're small.
Miniaturizing things, it always makes things better, as Elizabeth Holmes didn't find out.
Right.
Right.
All right. One more. This one comes from someone in the Ukraine. I won't use his name because I'm going to be playing a little name that logical fallacy. I usually don't name the authors of those. But from the Ukraine, a listener writes, "Guys, I have been listening to you for around 2 years and want to admit that your perspective on GMO and the way you champion it seems rather weird for me. Everyone has the right to choose, so if you opt for GMO, it is up to you and it is your choice. But why do you want other people share, it's a little, English is a little bit off, share and accept your view of that this food is quite harmless and is good? You like to reference to scientific research claiming that no harm was detected by experiments. Guys, but if one day some scientist finds something wrong, what will you say then? There are no perfect scientists in this world, because otherwise we would have remedies for AIDS, cancer, and many other incurable diseases. I mean remedies that work 100% for all people. From my personal experience, I must admit that after eating some GM fruit, my digestive system starts crashing, or at least I feel less comfortable as I do after eating natural ones. Your narrative about Bangladesh children going blind due to vitamin A deficiency is rather frustrating, and of course golden rice may be short-term solution for this issue. Not all people who resist GMO is resisting saving poor kids. So in this particular case, it may be the lifeline if no other short-term means are affordable. Yet you should try to keep natural food and try to increase it by natural means, not by stepping into nature itself and creating biological monsters.
Okay.
Please don't be
no
so specific. Yeah, it's certain talking about the things which are not explored thoroughly by humanity, and do not impose your view on GMOs to your listeners. Thank you. So
there's so many logical fallacies.
Unpack that.
There's a lot of logical fallacies in here. So that's okay. I mean, but this is what this people are indoctrinated into, this narrative, right? This is what happens, and this is, it takes a lot to get out of this, because you have to recognize a lot of what could be subtle errors in logic here. But I think that's why this is useful to go through.
Well, the first one is the most obvious. It's the – I always mix it up. Is it the naturalistic or appeal to nature?
It's the appeal to nature.
Appeal to nature is what it's actually called. Okay.
Yeah, the naturalistic fallacy is the is-ought problem. Like to say, this happens in nature, therefore it's ethical.
Whereas he does both of those.
Well, yeah, he does. But the appeal to nature is just, it's natural is good and things that are not natural are inherently bad.
Yeah.
And they're related. They are related. So, but We do tend to use that terminology.
But yeah, the appeal to nature is like the most obvious. It's the one he goes back to a few times.
Yes.
And he actually, like, you can map out when he uses it. You can, like, quote him on when he's actually using it.
And the flip side to that is calling GMO biological monsters. That's Frankenfood fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing monstrous about GMOs, right? And just like, it's like calling a gene variant, a mutation, or a mutant. Okay, there's a certain technical use of the term mutation, but everything is a mutation. No one condition of a gene is any more, quote-unquote, natural than any other one.
Oh, yeah,
it's all variations. It's just all genetic variation.
Right. So the first life that ever existed, that's pure unmutated, you know. Anything after that is a monster. Anything after the first unit of life.
We're all monsters, you know, basically.
I'm a monster.
And again, it gets to the idea that the method of change matters. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like if we could cultivate the rice, that's better than directly manipulating the genes to create the rice. Why? The only thing that matters, that's the genetic fallacy, that something's source determines its quality, when in fact the only thing that matters is it safe and does it work? What is it like now? Doesn't matter how you got there. You know, the method of production is irrelevant to the quality of the thing itself, you know?
Well, and this, I don't know if it's a logical fallacy or if he's just like wrong, but when he does the whole, maybe it's the, you know, the plural of anecdote is not data. What's the logical fallacy that
it's an appeal to anecdote.
Appeal yeah, to an appeal anecdote. To anecdote. So because he's like, but in my experience, when I eat them, my guts are destroyed, which
starts
is like
crashing.
First of all, there's just no way for you to not be that, not be a placebo. You already know what you think is going to happen. And second of all, there are so many studies that show that people cannot tell the difference because there is no difference, even at the molecular level.
Right. You can't tell the difference.
You can't tell the difference because it's the same food.
Exactly. That would have to be a placebo effect because, there's no evidence that when people are blinded, they cannot tell if they're eating, you know, something that's GMO or not GMO or organic or not organic. You can't tell.
You can't even tell, like, under a micro, unless you're specifically changing a portion of the gene that has, like, a phenotypic outcome. But lots of times, if it's producing a certain toxin or it's doing, the cells look the same. It's all turtles all the way down. It looks the same.
It's not like Blade Runner, where you got an electron microscope and you see an actual code written at the molecular level. That's not how it is. And it's a situation also where I would like to show this gentleman, if you know, that image, that great image of what corn used to look like.
Oh yeah,
like,
or a carrot.
Do you realize the monstrosity mutated thing that you're eating in your ear of corn?
All of our
look
food,
like a monster.
All of our food are monstrous, but if you compare it to its original form,
the original carrot,
with very few exceptions. Yeah,
but Steve, that's because there are no perfect scientists in this world.
Yeah. So what fallacy is that?
Straw man.
It's the Nirvana fallacy, right? So we don't have a perfect cure that cures 100% of all people. Therefore, scientists know nothing. We can't trust what scientists are saying, right? They're not perfect scientists. I could basically arbitrarily dismiss any consensus or conclusion of scientific research I don't like because scientists aren't perfect. They haven't 100% cured all of cancer.
Right.
So what do they know? That's the Nirvana fallacy.
And his examples were telling, I think, AIDS. Hello, have you been following AIDS research and cancer? You know, incremental changes every year, incremental changes. If you look at the advances in the past 10, 20 years, it's stunning. It's not 100%, but it's clear progress. I mean, what should we do with that? Do away with all of that?
Yeah, the examples are odd. So like in AIDS is a good example. HIV is all natural. That evolved completely on its own. Mm-hmm. And that is nature, right? That's nature trying to kill us, which is generally what it tries to do. And in 30 years, AIDS went from a death sentence within a few years for most people to a chronic issue that we could manage with almost no decrease in your life expectancy. And we're starting to cure people of it.
It's remarkable.
That's a remarkable success story for science. That's the worst example he could have chosen to make his
point. Like, is there a logical fallacy in which the examples that people use to make their point prove how poor their grasp is of the subject that they're trying to argue?
Yeah, it becomes a non sequitur, but it's but that's an interesting phenomenon where you actually prove the opposite with the example that you give.
Like, I don't really understand the fundamental science that I'm arguing against, and I'll show you by giving you a bunch of examples that show my lack of an understanding of the fundamental science. What about the one that's like the burden of proof, where it does kind of feel like what he's saying is like you need to disprove that there's a chance in the future that blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, you need to prove, my friend, now this is dangerous, because there is so much evidence out there that shows that there's no risk to health or human safety. It's like you just forgot to read the literature.
Right.
So you're flipping the burden of proof around on us.
Right. It's like, walk down the stairs. Can you tell me that's 100% safe? I cannot. People die every year walking down the stairs. Does that – so you, why would you want 100% – how could you possibly want or need 100%?
Well, Bob, how many more people must die before we regulate stairs?
That's right.
That's the precautionary principle gone out of control. And that's where anti-vaxxers come from, anti-GMOers come from, et cetera. It's like they take the precautionary principle and say, I want you to prove to me 100% that there's zero risk. It's like, as you say, there's no, that doesn't exist in life.
Yeah, you can't do
nothing
that.
Nothing you do has 0% risk.
There would be no medicine if that were the burden of proof. None.
And the burden, the thing is, at a certain point, the burden switches to the other person. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah,
unless
once you get
you can show us that there is a direct link. And we're seeing people try to do it in court, but they're not using good evidence. They're just saying, oh, look at this court case. And it's like, nope, sorry, that's not scientific evidence. That's 12 jurors who don't understand the science, having their emotions appealed to.
But that hasn't happened with GMOs yet. They're talking about glyphosate. That's different than GMOs.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But obviously, those things are all mixed up in people's heads as well.
I know. Yeah. But on purpose, that's by design.
Yeah.
Sure. They think that good is the enemy of perfect.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I mean, you know, this. I appreciate the emailer for writing these questions.
You.
These are... We get these questions all the time. This is the standard propaganda that's being fed out there, and it takes a lot of work to undo it, but it really is a logical house of cards that collapses when you explore it closely, and we're just trying to get people to understand that these arguments are not valid. And when you really dig down, the anti-GMO crowd really doesn't have any valid arguments, in my opinion. They all collapse when you take a close look at them. We can't feed the world without modern farming, so we got to figure something out.
Yeah, I know. It's like, what's the alternative, my friends? That's such a common – that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, I know. We're going to get lost in the weeds here, Kara. All right.
Hi-yo. That was like an Evan joke, Steve.
It was. Let's move on to science or fiction.
He's allowed.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate you giving me permission to use a bad pun.
Yeah.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week, and the theme is historical illness. So these are historical figures who had some kind of medical illness. And I want you to tell me if this is real or not. Got it?
Ooh,
it'll become even more obvious when I tell you the items. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Although officially attributed to strokes, there is strong evidence that Vladimir Lenin suffered from and ultimately died from syphilis. Item number two. Winston Churchill was diagnosed as an adult with bipolar disorder. And item number three. While Thomas Edison suffered from several chronic illnesses, the most significant contribution to his death was likely accidental mercury poisoning. Bob, go first.
Let's see. Lenin, syphilis. Let's see. Let me flip my pirate coin here. All right. Let's go to number two. Winston, bipolar. Is that even a term? Was bipolar disorder even a term? Back then.
See, now you're using your knowledge of science in order to determine the plausibility of these questions.
Let's see. We've got Edison. Sure. I mean, yeah, mercury poisoning. He was messing around with all sorts of stuff. That wouldn't surprise me. So they're all possible. Yeah, Kara, just, you know, get your pirate coin like me. So let's see. I will go with bipolar fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, I think I'll go that way as well. Lenin suffered from and ultimately died from syphilis. Syphilis was terrible, terrible, still is, terrible disease. And, you know, early 20th century, I think there was quite a bit of syphilis flying around with not good treatments for it. But Churchill, I've never heard of him being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I know probably a little bit more maybe than average about Winston Churchill. I read some books and watched some documentaries, and I find him just totally fascinating. Never once has the word bipolar come up in all those things. So that's what's leaning me in that direction. And Edison, yeah, accidental mercury poisoning, sure. I mean, you know, gosh, what wasn't he tinkering with? You know, he could have died from probably many types of poisoning of all sorts of things. And mercury must have been among his elements that he would often handle or be exposed to. So I think that one's plausible. Therefore, Churchill, bipolar, fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I mean, I guess I gotta go with the guys. Like, syphilis, sure. Syphilis definitely, like, does horrible things to your brain. I could see it having some sort of relationship to a stroke. Mercury poisoning, Edison, I don't know, heavy metal toxicity, working on, you know, light bulbs and shit. It seems like it could happen. And he invented, like, so many things, right? He was always just, like, tinkering in probably a highly unregulated laboratory environment. And mercury's horrible in even in low doses. And yeah, I guess it's probably a good thing that Bob, unless he's about to sweep us, it's probably a good thing that you went first, because I probably wouldn't have made that distinction there, that really? There's no way he could have been. Yeah, because I never read these carefully enough. Like, he was diagnosed as an adult is pretty clear. That means it would have had to happen in his lifetime. It wouldn't have been able to happen after the fact. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, I know for a fact that bipolar used to be manic depression. That's right, what they called it. But I don't know when the switchover was. Churchill is still not from that. I think we think of Churchill as this mythical figure from so long ago. But like, did he die? It wasn't that long ago.
He died in the 60s.
Yeah. So, okay. That's sure. Kind of like the Haldol revolution. It's sort of when we were still calling people like neurotic versus psychotic. Those were like common phrases that we use. Like, the neurotics were the people with mood disorders and the psychotics were the people with thought disorders. Yeah, bipolar would have been manic depression, I think, as far back as the 60s, but I don't know when that changeover would have happened. I do know that, like, Churchill was like a dick, right? Like, he was a great guy, like, when it comes to being a statesman, but wasn't he in his interpersonal life? Like, he had a lot of conflict with, he didn't get along with people well. Obviously, people with bipolar are not by their nature dicks. There's no real correlation there. But if he had an undiagnosed mood disorder that had some manic episodes related to it, he might in his manic times have been difficult to get along with, for example, especially if he wasn't being treated for it. So you might be getting us on this, and maybe he was diagnosed with something else. But if this is the one, yeah, it would be because he would have had manic depression, not technically bipolar, even though it's the same thing. It's just called something different. So I'll go with the boys.
All right. So let's take this in order. We'll start with number one. Although officially attributed to strokes, there is strong evidence that Vladimir Lenin suffered from and ultimately died from syphilis. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Nice.
Okay. So, yeah. So, this at the time, to avoid embarrassment, you know, the public was told that Lenin had strokes, and he probably did. But in retrospect, this is now like historical diagnosis. If you look at the records at the time, it was an open secret among his doctors and among scientists and other people in the know at the time that Lenin had syphilis. He probably caught it many years earlier. They think he caught it from, they say, a Parisian prostitute in the early 20th century. And it developed into tertiary neurosyphilis. It affected his brain. And towards the end, he basically went mad with tertiary syphilis. He had all the typical symptoms and died, you know, very quickly in a way that is, you know, typical of untreated, you know, late stage tertiary syphilis. So syphilis is a very serious disease, but it's cured by antibiotics. It's one of these diseases that it did turn into nothing, and it's still susceptible to antibiotics as well. So
yeah, it's not like gonorrhea.
Yeah, you catch it early and you treat it, and it really is a nothing disease. But it was this scourge.
Oh, it ate people's faces away.
Yeah,
like it was.
Yeah, I've seen some nasty pictures.
There's have you guys been to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia?
No.
There's like a wall of syphilitic skulls. And you can see all the malformations that happened to people's skulls from syphilis over the years. Fascinating.
Yes. And it's funny, like up until like the 30s, 1940s, even the 1950s, any unknown neurological condition was was diagnosed as syphilis.
Mm. Oh, nice.
And in that way, it was kind of the Lyme disease of its day. Mm-hmm.
Fatigue syndrome.
It was a great mimicker, and it was sort of the default diagnosis if you didn't know what else. What's funny? Like, acyloclast, the Abrams black box machine.
Oh, the dynamite?
Yeah, the dynamite.
Oh my gosh, you just said like seven words and I still don't know what you're talking about.
So at the early in the 20th century, there was a doctor, Abrams, who invented this fake diagnostic and then therapeutic machine that would use radio waves. You would like put a drop of blood on a piece of paper, put it in the machine, and it would spit out a diagnosis. And then it was investigated by Scientific American. After he died, they were able to crack one open, and it was full of it didn't even work. Like, it was just full of loose machine parts.
So it was like Theranos. Right.
Ball bearings.
Yeah, a fraud within a fraud. But one of the most common diagnoses it spit out was syphilis. That was like what everyone had, pretty much.
The catch-all.
Yeah, that was the catch-all.
He probably has syphilis.
Right. All right, let's move on to number two. Winston Churchill was diagnosed as an adult with bipolar disorder. You all think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Damn it.
Oh, my gosh.
When was the switchover?
No way.
So I don't know when the switchover was, but he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder by his doctor, Lord Moran, who diagnosed him, it just says, when he was middle-aged. And he had periods of intense depression, what he would call his black dog days. He had fits of mania. He was very restless. He had very little sleep. Like, he would be up all night. So he had definitely had his manic phases. So he was officially given that diagnosis by his physician while he was still alive. So diagnosed as an adult. Okay, let's move on to the third one. While Thomas Edison suffered from several chronic illnesses, the most significant contribution to his death was likely accidental mercury poisoning. This one is the fiction. I just completely made up the mercury poisoning thing because it sounded plausible and you guys all fell for it. He died of diabetes. That's it. He was diabetic.
Complication.
He was 83 and he's an old, overweight guy. He died of diabetes. Yeah, very mundane. It wasn't, but you think it's like he's an iconic figure. You like to think of him as experimenting and he got exposed to something
Sure.
Right? It just kind of fits his idiom.
Yeah. Marie Curie, radon kind of thing,
So just so that you know, Steve, bipolar didn't show up in the DSM until 1980.
Yeah.
Ooh. So he might have been diagnosed manic depressive.
The document that I'm reading says bipolar disorder. Early 1950s. Early 1950s.
In the ICD?
I'm just saying, the first reference I came up with said, the changing from using manic depression to bipolar disorder in the early 1950s.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, that's earlier than I thought. All right.
I'm just saying, I don't know if you could technically have it be a diagnosis, but that's okay. All right. I'll give up on my fight. It's cool.
Right. Anyway, so there's nuances here, Kara. I will grant you that there are technicalities, but he was given that diagnosis. Apparently, it was around at that time. Apparently, but
none of that changes the fact that Edison absolutely didn't die of mercury poisoning.
That is true as well.
No, that's true.
Damn it, you swept us.
I did. I came across some other interesting things too, but they were more speculative.
Like what?
There's a lot of speculation that Thomas Jefferson was on the autism spectrum.
Huh.
That's interesting.
Probably would have been diagnosed with Asperger's when that was a thing, or now just on the on this autism spectrum.
Wait, they don't say Asperger's anymore?
No. They basically combined it with autism.
Makes sense.
Because, apparently he was very antisocial, was very uncomfortable in social situations, didn't like to give public speeches, was very awkward, was very focused and obsessive about things. But again, that, we're trying to retroactively diagnose from the historical records. That's mm-hmm. always tricky. It's fun. It's fun to speculate, like, what did Van Gogh have or whatever. Just pick somebody that had some weird symptom to try to fit it with a modern medical diagnosis. But it's, you can't really confidently make the diagnosis. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
The aim of argument or of discussion should not be victory, but progress. Nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. Joseph Joubert, whom I don't believe we've spoken about before on the show, but he lived from 1754 to 1824 in Paris, of course, was a French moralist and essayist, remembered today largely for his Thoughts, or Pensées, which were published posthumously, which means after he died.
Thank you.
He was not published at all while he was alive, only afterwards. But it's been translated into many languages, and his work seems interesting. I'm going to look into it a little more.
So, guys, registration opened today as we're recording, so it'll be opened when this podcast goes up for Nexus. So go to ness.org and register for the conference, for workshops, for the extravaganza. We're all going to be there. It's going to be a ton of fun. July 12 to 14 in New York City. Hope to see some of you there. NECSS.org. All right. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Nighty night.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.